Yo, yo, welcome to Crypto 101. This is Matthew Aaron. And a question that always crosses my mind, I think maybe yours too. Are ICOs all BS? Well, on this episode, we have Peter Woodard of IVC Group. He's an ICO consultant. And we ask him that very question. And he gets down to all different aspects of an ICO. From starting, to marketing, to profiling, to token sales, and beyond. Very interesting conversation coming up. I hope you enjoy it. We'll see you after the show. All right, Pete, very nice to meet you, and thank you for coming on the show.
Matthew, thanks for having me.
Hey, just to get started, you know, just if you could just tell the listeners just a little bit about yourself. We go from there.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm, along with a couple others, a co-founder of IVC Group. I originally started out in Canada, so in Toronto, migrated over to London for about 5 or 6 years, and now split time between San Francisco and Mexico City, so jumping around quite a bit. My background's a bit mixed. So education-wise, it's been a bit of engineering, a bit of business. I started off in the ad tech space in London. So I helped scale a Google-backed venture in the ad tech space, and then went into fintech. Been there for 5-6 years, and now, as a lot of people have, sort of migrated into blockchain from fintech.
So can you tell us a little bit about what is fintech and IBC Group?
Sure. So fintech is just financial technology. So there was probably a wave about, call it 4 years ago. It's still going on and it's still very strong. Sort of fintech's been around for quite a long time, I'd say, but it was coined maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And it just happened to be that London was a really good center for fintech. And I think a lot of the same centers you see in fintech are the ones that are currently in crypto and blockchain. So you have London, which is one, you have Singapore, Hong Kong, Asia as well, and then you have obviously the US. In terms of like the fintech centers, I think you'll see something very similar in the blockchain space. And they're all of them have been regulated differently. And there's all the way regulators have essentially approached fintech is also the way I probably see them approaching possibly in blockchain as well, where you have like the FCA approach in the UK, where it's creating sort of regulatory sandboxes and allowing sort of the market to mature around the regulation, where the SEC historically has sort of put a thumb out on things and tried to draft a regulation around sort of their interpretation of best practices, which is not necessarily exactly the way we're seeing in crypto now, but there is a definite flavor of what I saw in fintech. So like fintech, that wave, you know, I think when I was in London, there was a lot going on there and lots of innovation and a really collaborative effort and community. And then that's very much, I think, where crypto is now. And we took a lot of that sediment from the fintech phase into kind of what IBC is doing now. So from our side, we were focusing on sort of two streams. One is the ICO market, and the other is the enterprise blockchain side. And obviously the ICO market currently is quite interesting. Like, you know, 400 ICOs launched last week as of, I think it was like, you know, the week of the 9th that we're talking now. And what was it? 95% of ICOs were funded in July of this year, where 35% of ICOs were funded in October of this year. Mm. So there's a huge shift, which I think is sort of has to happen. And the sort of, as they all say, like the FOMO that was in July has sort of changed slightly and they're a bit more apprehensive. And that's on both sides of the market, I think. There's still like called the retail side, the normal investor, which there's still a lot of volume behind, but the accredited investors, high net worths, family offices, institutions, they're a bit more cautious, I think, than they were probably earlier on in the year.
I got to bring you back, and because this is Crypto 101, and you're dropping a lot of words that we're assuming everybody knows. But what is fintech? 101, what is fintech?
Sure. Well, fintech's just financial technology.
Okay.
It's anything to do with digitizing financial services.
Okay.
And they kind of broke it off from there. You might have heard the word like insurtech, prop tech, which is property technology. But fintech is a lot of different areas. So you could call someone like Stripe, like a payment processor, that could be fintech.
Mm-hmm.
You could call like an online loan management system fintech.
Right.
So it's very much all encompassing. And it's still, like, I think blockchain sort of eclipsed it in terms of popularity or, you know, the interest around it. But it's still very much a lot what big institutions are doing. They're trying to digitize and get everything off of a paper-based format and move it into a digital format.
So IBC Consulting is just a consulting group, and you guys are now consulting ICOs as well. What is it like to consult an ICO and some of the issues that are coming around with that?
It's a mix. It depends where they're coming from, really. It can be everything from trying to figure out like a validation process in their business exactly how they should execute an ICO. So it's a bit easier if they're coming from like a new product point of view, that's a bit easier to sort of wrap it around it. If they are like an existing company and looking at a potential ICO, it depends what they want to get out of it. So if they want to, let's say, raise funds directly for the company, then that's one thing. It's mostly going to be probably a security because there's people investing in their company or their ICO to get something out of it. But companies are also looking at how they can support their ecosystem or their industry. And those cases are really interesting because you can get very creative around both how they can profit or they can grow as a company, but also when they're looking at the industry, you know, what's lacking. So we're working with a company that's looking at how can they make supply chain management better. So essentially they could, you know, own the protocol underneath the system, but it would support the industry as a whole. So it really depends where they're coming from. And you see a lot of different cases, some people with great ideas, but it's always about if they can execute or not. I think it's always a
right.
practical question for the industry that it can be a very, very elaborate idea, but it can often be bringing them back down to earth that, like yes, it's a great idea to have a payment system that sidesteps AML KYC or sidesteps Visa, MasterCard, but is that legal? Like, are you going to go to jail? So, it's a real mix for depending on where the client's coming from.
I guess the obvious question after that is, how many ICOs are bullshit?
Well, you probably group them. It depends what you mean by bullshit. So there's lots of really crazy.
I mean scammy bullshit. I mean, the number that's flying around the internet right now is 95% of ICOs are scams. This is just, you know, the Reddit talk.
Yeah,
do you agree?
Scams, well, not necessarily, because a scam would mean that they're operating under false pretense, right? They you may look back on and go, well, this company was a scam, but maybe they had the best intention at heart, but they were too early. They were pioneers and they kind of were too early for the market.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't execute. You could even say, like, for example, with what's going on with Tezos, which you say they're a scam because they haven't hit their milestones. They could have had the best intentions, but because they, I think in the legal papers, they've missed obviously a number of milestones, and people could call them a scam. But I obviously don't know what's happening internally. But the ones we come across, I haven't come across many that are clear scams. Like, I've come across ones who say that they want to basically replicate BitConnect, and I think BitConnect has this air of a Ponzi scheme.
Mm-hmm.
But that's very few and far between. There's people that have great ideas and, you know, even if they're given 20, 30 million through an ICO, I don't know if they'd be able to execute their idea. And that could be because of them or the market. So I don't know if I necessarily agree. I think we'll see, you know, next year, a lot of that thrown around in the news because people won't be able to execute their idea. But being like a true scam, like a Ponzi scheme or similar, I don't think so.
So then you have faith in the ICO kind of service, that the idea of ICO, or do you think that it should be more IPO regulated, where they have to jump through a lot more hoops and go over hurdles to get this money?
I don't think so. I think like, if you look at sort of crowdfunding, let's say, where, you know, there's laws for accredited investors and laws for retail investors, and I'm sure and the reason the regulations are there to supposedly protect the investor. And I think a lot of retail people are much more savvy than the regulators think they are. They sort of group into one group or the other. And, you know, if you, just because you don't make over, let's say in the US, like 200K a year or have X amount in assets, then, you know, there's a lot of people in crypto, which has allowed them to get into investing in technology. And obviously we saw a massive growth, and the growth hasn't been from the institutional side. It's been from normal people like you and I that have gone to invest into crypto. So there has to be some level of regulation involved.
Right.
But to put like the same regulation that we've seen with securities or fintech, then I think that like fintech is a great example, because I think the regulation there essentially stifled growth in a lot of different countries. Where
how
with
so?
IC, well, you most of like take the US for example. A lot of the laws pertaining to retail investors took a long time to draft, and when they draft them, there was state regulation and federal regulation. So it was a bit unclear which one you fell under. And I think they're about a year or over late to draft these regulations. So it didn't allow, I guess, the equity and debt crowdfunding side to really scale as it could have, where obviously with the ICO space, it just went absolutely crazy.
Right.
And they're just trying to pull it back. But I think, of course, what we'll see with these ICOs is I hope people don't lose, you know, the life savings, what they were sort of putting in, what they know they could have lost. I'm sure there'll be people that have lost a lot of money. But I think overall, it's allowed to sort of go crazy, and then each country is sort of trying to reel back in and find a best practice for everyone.
I guess when you say crowdfunding, and I guess here's the problem I have with it. When you put something up on a Kickstarter, you're looking for $100,000 or $10,000, and you're making a thermos that doesn't spill when you knock it off your table or something, you know? But an ICO is looking for millions of dollars, and they're promising huge developments in technology that doesn't honestly exist right now. Mm. And they're collecting, like I said, a lot of money. Is there a limit? Is there a tipping point in amount of funds or amount of promises where it's not crowdfunding anymore?
That's a good question. I can't give you an exact example of which product it was, but there was a product, I think it was a drone, wasn't it, with Kickstarter that raised millions of dollars that never actually shipped, which is actually sounds like it's sort of like the same as an ICO, which raised millions of dollars and never produced the product. But the thing is, I guess, with ICOs is one thing is you have a product, and after the product's complete, they also have to bring on paying customers into their product. So that's a whole other, I guess, whole other thing that we'll see, I imagine, in time to come. So I think what we see now is that ICOs, they understand, because that figure of 35% in October, they're now looking at going, well, I don't think we can raise, you know, and then they know they can't raise 10, so I'll call it 10, 15 million off the back of a white paper and a team. So most now are moving towards a model where they have an MVP. Obviously, MVPs can be anything. They could be a clickable prototype. The more reputable ICOs say, listen, we know that we can't go off the back of a white paper. We're developers. We're going to basically do an alpha, and we're going to put it into the market. And ideally, these people have, I don't want to say customers, but users before they enter the ICO space. And that's going to become more the norm. So you have, call it the VC world, but you have sort of more of the traditional startup investment space coming into the ICO world.
Trying to segue into another portion of the ICO, and I know I'm beating up the ICO right now because it's just something that's on everybody's mind. I never had an opportunity to talk to a consultant that deals with this, so I think this is very interesting. And I think that the listeners always want to know, like, a lot of people are trying to get involved with these ICO or pre-token sales or token sales or what have you, and they're all like on the fence. And I really like what you said when you said that everybody comes in with good intentions, but can they deliver? And there's not really an individual that is saying, hey, I'm gonna do an ICO because I want to get rich and then go to Cancun.
Yeah.
But you know, with that, I'm just wondering, what's your opinion on the blockchain space with the lack of regulation and ICOs? How is that affecting the blockchain space, the cryptocurrency space, and the markets right now?
So I think we're seeing a lot of different changes in regulation. I hope personally that they don't regulate it too much where you go the route of what we just spoke about, where you have to be an accredited investor or the rules are very complex. But I do see a need for regulation, and it could be a lot of different things. So like the need for AML KYC practices, just to make sure.
AML KYC, what is that?
It's anti-money laundering and know your customer checks.
Okay.
So like you might sell this through as a CoinList or SAP launch where they operate in the US. And they ensure they know the source of the funds. And you know that sort of regulation I think is fine. Like it is slowing down things like onboarding of investors into ICOs. There's some people out there, like Identity Mind is one company I've contacted before, and they're doing, that's what they do, identity checks for investment type platforms. And like that's fine. I think that we don't want, dirty money coming into the space. We want to make sure that it's all kind of above board and clean money. But in terms of what's happening in regulation, it has to happen. I think every jurisdiction will take their own approach to it. I just really hope, and we're talking more of the ICO space, because I think enterprise blockchain won't have this problem because they'll go through sort of, I think, traditional VC routes rather than an ICO, I personally. But for the ICO space, I do hope, because you'll see, they could put a massive halt to it if they say, well, listen, there can be no ICOs are illegal tomorrow, then it'll just sort of stifle innovation. Because I'm sure, yes, a lot of these ICOs will fail, but maybe one thing to think about is what sort of technology will come out of all of those failures. Like there could be a lot of really good technology that then gets passed on and reused in the market.
Do you think that these recent forks with Bitcoin are necessary, or do you think that it's a money grab?
I don't really follow it, to be honest. Like
okay.
I
fair enough.
Like for example, like with the forks, it definitely affects like the altcoin market, which directly affects the ICO market. Like we saw when SegWit2x was called off. One member of the team pinged me about it, and I obviously did a right grab for Blockfolio to see how much the alts have pumped. So like the marketplace there is, why people are taking money from their alts, putting the Bitcoin, getting the fork, and putting it back in. So, apart from that, like it does for ICOs, it does affect maybe when you're going to launch the ICOs, because if all the money is in Bitcoin and they're waiting for a fork, then less attention will be on the ICOs and basically less ether or less crypto flying around. But that's sort of the only consideration. Like I was really big into trading. We'll call it for the golden months, where it's sort of like August, September, which you couldn't essentially lose. But it's it's an all-consuming hobby or job, and it's something that's fun to do for a bit, and it's just right. Not conducive to trying to get work done.
I think most of the listeners right now are going to sympathize with that and know how much time it is. Actually, a couple of the listeners have expressed to me how they had to back away from trading because of anxiety.
Yeah, well, all you do is basically watch the front page of Bittrex all day in charts. and with trading in all markets, if you have the information first, then you're in. But I think I said all of August, I was just glued to my screen. And I kind of came up the tail end of August going, I can't do this anymore. I have to put it all in my wallet and just, maybe check my was a Blockfolio every once a day and then just leave it. But actively trading, no. I'm sure your listeners, they know that they've all gone through it. And I think it was hilarious seeing the crypto traders that came out of like August and September, which, like I said, like if you invested any money into any protocol that looked good, like NEO or OMG or Pay or 10x and so on,
right.
you basically you couldn't lose. You're getting like 80-90% gains. So
right. Just talking about your trading in your market, since we're on the subject, what was your biggest win or biggest loss
in terms of trading?
Yeah.
So I saw the original news of OMG about the McDonald's partnership. So I saw that. I think I picked it up around like $1.10.
Whoa.
I think it was. So I took a punt on it, and it went quite well. And same as NEO. So I bought NEO just after the Ant shares rebranding.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, once again, you couldn't really lose. I don't have tons vested in the market. Just sort of money that I knew I could lose, and it's gone, you know, relatively well. What's my probably the one that still gets me to this day is the stupid trade on AdX. So I saw AdX at about $1.20, $1.30, I think it was, and I was like, oh well, it's gonna keep going up, and I bought it without too much research into it, and then shortly after, it just basically completely ate shit from there.
Yeah.
And I'm still holding it going. It got almost to no loss about a month ago, and I got greedy again and said, "Now I'll keep it." And here we're still down 25%, and it's been, you know, two, three months or something. So no major losses. Like I doubled down a bit of NIO, and I thought it was going to keep going up. And then basically when the Chinese regulation came in, what was it? NIO, AdX, Quantum. They all just like completely dropped, and I'm still just holding them. I'm gonna wait it out and see if they go back up. Then great. If not, then it's been a fun ride.
Yeah, you actually probably have the same portfolio that I was having at the time, and I got into NIO when it was AntShares, so I went up to 54 on it, and then I bailed out at $18 after the China news.
I'm just looking at it now. It's around 30 something, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, 30, 32. Actually, the one that got me was NAV. I was looking at NAVCoin when it was, I don't know, like 20 or 30 cents. And since then, it's gone like 100-something% and then down again and up again. You could have really done well. And it looked like a solid coin. I was sick of watching the market. So I just let it ride everything else. And I've watched it go up way too much since then.
My brother found NAVCoin for us, and we actually hopped in at the 20 cents, and he did it really well on NAV, and now we're all invested in NAV still, so
nice.
NAV was a good one. Música no discrimina a nadie, así que vamos a romper toda mi gente se mueve. Mira el ritmo como los tiene. For the listeners, I paused it and then we had a conversation and then we started the recording again. But he mentioned that there are different investors getting into the game because of different ICOs and because of different things that are happening in the market. Can you explain about that?
A bit of insight into the ICO process is like a Filecoin is a great example of exactly what happened, where most ICOs, when they have their pre-ICO, will already be shopping around their ICO to high net worths, to family offices, to institutions, trying to get a big allocation from a small number of investors. The best way to sort of format these is if like the ICO can have a large amount of the allocation already soaked up pre-ICO, then obviously when the full ICO goes, there's only a smaller amount to get to the hard cap, essentially. But that's in an ideal scenario. The market has changed a bit in the sense that a lot of ICOs now are struggling to get their high net worth or institutional money. This is because of a lot of different things. One is like on the spectrum of traditional investing, Bitcoin is extremely risky and ICOs are just off the chart. So there's so much money trying to get in, but they're trying to get in the least risky way possible, which is why you've seen so many, you know, crypto hedge funds or crypto funds pop up, because it's a bit easier to get some skin into the game, or sort of an intro into crypto by doing that, where somebody will manage the money, but maybe have 60% of the fund in something more stable like Bitcoin or similar. For an ICO, if they can show you, okay, after the ICO, this is our roadmap, and this is also our roadmap to our customers and paying customers, and that's a bit an easier sell to these high net worth individuals or on the higher end of the market. If it's very speculative, I'm sure if you had like the best team behind it, with the best institutions, then yes, like they'll still invest into it. But I think it's becoming harder and harder to get that pre-allocation of money on. Once again, if it's a very abstract idea, then it's a bit harder to explain to traditional investors that they're used to stock markets, used to bonds, they're used to, you know, people managing their money for them. And a very like practical point on this is if you went to let's say your money manager tomorrow and said, hey, buy me, you know, $500,000 worth of Bitcoin, then they could probably do that, But then also the question is how do they store that Bitcoin? So are they going to have it in like a Tezos wallet or a Trezor wallet, sorry, in their desk, in their office, or what are they going to do with it? So there's lots of things I don't think people think about in terms of the investment in these ICOs. Well, on the other end, you have, you know, the people like you and I, which the other side of this, sort of to kind of digress, but a lot of people have made a lot of money with ICOs. So someone who's invested into Ethereum in January, let's say, has essentially made a lot of money. It's gone from whatever it is, $10 up to we're at $300 now. So there's lots of money flowing around the market that obviously they've made the call, they made the investment. But it's not money maybe they thought they've worked very hard for, you know? So there's a lot, like that speculative money is very much more willing to take risks because their $1,000 is now worth $100,000 and they can go and make more risk. So there's two ends of the market there. I still think there's a lot, there's just so many ICOs going on that, you know, someone's going to be an Ethereum killer or a Bitcoin killer, or it's going to be the next generation XYZ. And I think it's hard for the market sometimes to differentiate what's going to win and what's not going to win. You know, so there's a lot. I think from what we've seen is there's a lot of different forces at play in the market, coming from a lot of different angles.
Since you're consulting these ICOs, a direct question would be: do you guys take investor profiling into consideration when consulting? And the other one is: what are some of the things on the checklist that you kind of check off when consulting these ICOs? Okay, so we're gonna get VC money. Check. We're going to get this kind of demographic to get interested into your ICO. Check. We're going to position you this way.
So it's not us coming up with the idea at the end of the day. So we take on ICOs that we believe in, and also as a company, people have, you know, external interests, whether it's sort of like esports or it's high finance, whether it's hedge funds or whatever, it could be anything like, you know, asset management or whatever it is. If somebody has a real passion for it internally and can kind of add a lot of value, then those are the ones who take on. Like we get probably upwards of 100 inquiries a week. So it's a lot to get through, and we can only really take on the ones that we feel like we can add the most value to overall. So if the ones that are very abstract, then maybe not. If we see, okay, well, this is a supply chain management blockchain ICO for a particular industry, then we see, okay, great, there's a huge gap there, so we can really help. I think whenever I speak to business owners, ICOs, is like I don't think you can throw money at the, of course, it's great to have a very healthy marketing budget, let's say, or technology budget, legal budget. But I don't think you can throw money at the problem or money at the ICO. So I always say that you really should take the position of it being as organic as possible.
Right.
Or organic being in one area of the technology, you have all your milestones laid out and you start hitting those milestones before the ICO. So ideally you have that MVP, alpha, beta, which is ready to go for the market. And then you can use that afterwards to essentially drip feed into different channels. Same as sort of bringing on like partnerships. Something that we did in IBC a lot is try to make some really strong partnerships between people that we know within our network and companies as well.
Right.
So, you know, if you're a disrupting the insurance field, how can you partner with really prominent insurance providers or institutions in your vertical? So I think from a marketing standpoint, like a checklist, it's trying to get as many organic channels locked down or mapped out from the beginning of the process. So, yeah, I always like to take a look at some of the ICOs that you know, when you look at their site and you get retargeted for months upon months or weeks upon weeks, that it kind of loses its effectiveness, right? So there's only so many times you can go on YouTube and get retargeted on YouTube ads and get retargeted on Facebook ads. So ideally, you have this sort of perfect storm of really good organic partnerships, good growth on the technology side, and then also start having those institutional conversations or high net worth family office conversations at a very early stage and sort of build that up gradually. And we were speaking to someone who was having a really hard time post ICO with their communication channels. So they use Telegram, and there were sort of two sides of the coin. There was people that invested, so there's about 19,000 backers. They raised about $25 million, and half of the backers were, we love what you do. It was nothing around what's going to go to the moon. It's like, we love what you do. We can't wait until you roll your ecosystem. We're ready to use it. And the other half of the Telegram channel was saying, why haven't I got 4 or 5 times my money back yet? And they're having a real hard time. How do you sort of change that around? And what I told them was that they should really look at doing partnerships and start, you know, really delivering on their roadmap. Because if you are delivering on your pre-ICO promises, your ICO promises, then you're doing exactly, or you should be doing exactly what investors expect of you.
Right. That's very interesting. That's very interesting that the investors are looking for that 400 or 500%. Maybe not too realistic, but they do have to deal with that. Do you guys usually get paid in ICO tokens, or do you guys get paid cash?
It depends. It's a mix. So if we do sort of ad hoc work, so some people will say, listen, we need some help in our PR marketing channel or our technical channel, then we'll just do it on a contract basis. If we're more involved and more vested in the ICO success, then we'll look at, yeah, we'll take a position in the company, but mostly by tokens. That's the way we like to work, because it's a win-win for everyone, right? We're not going to charge a client 50 Bitcoin to get up and running. It's really about, we want to deliver on our promise to help them in their ICO. And if they win, we win as well.
Thank you very much for coming on the show. And, you know, the whole conversation about ICOs and the way that it's going to, you know, kind of like flow out in the future is just so interesting, because it's such a new market. Everything's unregulated, and we got to see how everything flows out, because people have money in it, and it's very risky and very nerve-wracking for a lot of people. And I think that you, with your insights about consulting and the way, a new way to look at ICOs and dealing with ICOs, probably set a lot of people's worries at ease.
Well, I hope so. I think the bottom line here is that we don't want to be overregulated, but at the same time, we don't want people to lose all their money either. I think we take for granted, because a lot of people probably listen to your podcast or heavily invested in the space. They read up constantly. But there are also the people that will put blind faith into an investment without any research. So it's a real, you know, the market's very, I think, very divided. And I think speaking to someone today and saying, you know, he's from a traditional finance background, and he was saying that, you know, my hairdresser was talking about Bitcoin. So nothing wrong with it with hairdressers, but from your hairdresser, you know, you should watch out, which is partly true, but not completely true.
But either. Can I ask this question? Isn't this an amazing point in time where the hairdresser can take more freedom with his money and start investing, opposed to, say, 92 tech bubble, where there is really no avenue for the hairdresser to get involved?
I completely agree. That's the whole thing about an ICO we were speaking about earlier, is that if you are a hairdresser or a bartender or whatever you are, it does give you the option. If you are really interested and you've done your research and background in the team and the protocol, or maybe you're a developer where you like really dug into the code on GitHub, then a regulator can't tell you cannot invest. It allows you to basically to trust your instincts and invest your capital wisely. And I think anyone that's smart, that they won't risk more than they're okay with losing. I think that's the sentiment. So I completely agree in terms of allowing the normal people to sort of take control of their own investments and their own finances. It's beautiful.
Pete, thank you very much for coming on the show, and I really enjoyed talking to you. And keep in touch, man. Let us know what's going on in the ICO market. If you find that anything is popping and cool, come back on and talk.
Of course. If you have me back, Matthew, I'll be back anytime.
Right on, Pete. Thank you very much, man. We'll talk to you later.
Cheers.
All right, bye. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of Crypto 101, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. This week was the first time that the interviewee didn't have any songs, so I reached out to one of my good friends, DJ DeVille, who's a resident DJ in Las Vegas. He was a music director in China in Shanghai. He travels around the world, Hong Kong, Japan, Germany, and he sent us some of his newest tracks. Those tracks are New Rules, second track, J Balvin, Mi Gente, third track, DJ Snake, A Different Way. And DJ DeVille's link is in the description. I have something else to say. We have just launched our website, and so I'm not going to end this with crypto_101. crypto_101. I'm just going to say all of our socials are on our website. Go to crypto101podcast.com. That's crypto101podcast.com. You can find all of our social media. You can email us. You can find our profiles. You can find our episodes. You can rate us and subscribe to our podcast. All on the website. Isn't this a beautiful thing? Lastly, over the course of 4 or 5 months of doing this podcast, we have grown and we have engaged a lot of people coming into the crypto space. We are fortunate and lucky to be in the position that we are in right now. But we want to still grow, and we want to make sure that we can reach more people and get more people engaged into blockchain. So therefore, we started a Patreon page and we have a donation page on our website. So whichever you feel comfortable, please go to our donation page. You can see that you can send us Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin. Of course, we accept cryptocurrency. And you can go to our Patreon page and donate there. You can start with the Lambos on the Moon level. Yes, it's $3 a month for Lambos on the Moon. And you can help us build Crypto 101 to reach more people. And for the $4 Raris on Mars level, actually, it makes me giggle when I say it. The $4 Raris on Mars level, you will have access to the rants and commentaries. We are making the rants and commentaries exclusive for our Patreon members. So please go to Patreon, help us out, help us grow, and help us reach more people to get them involved with cryptocurrency. Thank you very much for listening, and we will see you on the next episode of Crypto 101. This is Matthew Aaron.